this is Thor's Hour of Thunder. This is Thor, as usual, from Valhalla.
And broadcasting live from Joshua Tree National Park, this is Balls of the Brilliant. Feeling a little cold, because let me ask you something, Thor. What do you think is the weather in the desert is like?
I know in Vegas it's like 100 during the day and then like 30 at night. So I'm going to go with that for Joshua Tree also. Except you two filmed there, or you two had that album about Joshua Tree, or at least titled Joshua Tree, so I'm going to assume that it's actually 100 during the day and then Ireland at night.
Well, would you, when you say Ireland at night, would you suggest that it would like precipitate at all?
Based on other desert places I've been to, I assume it doesn't rain often, but when it does, it's like flash flooding because the soil can't absorb it.
Yep, I just experienced here the epic fail of the desert weather, which is rain and, would you believe it, snow.
Wait, you went to Joshua Tree and it snowed?
And it snowed.
And unlike when Sean normally says where he's from, this week he is not lying.
Who said I lie every other week? I lie 50% of the time.
That's true so far.
And that statement is part of the average, so, you know, figure out what's true, what's false. But yeah, no, in the desert recently, and it was snowing. Actually, hailing.
That's ridiculous. I went to a job interview, like, what was it, like a week and a half ago on a Monday morning, and when I left the house at 9 a.m. in New York City at the end of March, it was snowing. Only from 9 a.m. to 9:30. It was raining by the time I got downtown where the interview was, but I couldn't understand it at all. Charlotte, my girlfriend, left the house, and then I was waking up, you know, I was just getting up as she was leaving, and she comes back upstairs, and I'm like, what's going on? And she's grabbing, like, her winter coat, because she'd had on, you know, like, just, like, a little light coat, because it had been, like, 70 the day before. But no, it was 30 and snowing.
Dude, I thought we were the sky gods. How has nature bested us?
Well, it did you hear in D.C., speaking of sky gods, our good friend John Nappy, who's down at law school in D.C., sent me a text that just said, "Thunder snow! I shit you not! Check the weather! D.C., thunder snow!" And there was thunder snow in D.C., which neither me or him had realized was a thing. And I, as the god of thunder, should know this, but I didn't think thunder and snow mixed, other than...
Well, I've just had a brilliant idea here. Now, we are officially need to go on tour, and the tour's name is going to be Thundersnow.
You heard it
here first, listeners.
That's a genius plan. So, in terms of a rundown for what we're going to talk about this week, I saw Sucker Punch this weekend. It just came out. Everyone on Earth appears to have hated it, except for me. So I'll try and defend it. I mean, I'm really not sure. So other than that with the rundown, let's see. Nothing I want to talk about with comics this week. Anything else you have going on? There's a few.
Well, you're asking if I have a plan, and do I really look like a guy with a plan? Guy with a plan. Just do things. Yeah, no, so tell me about this Sucker Punch. It's a sort of, like, fantasy thing where the girl's hallucinating that she's on a parallel world while she's really just breaking out of boarding schools or something.
It's her her mom dies, and her sister inherit everything. So it takes place in, like, I guess the 50s, or possibly 40s in Vermont, and
it's kind of tragic, you know, just Vermont in general.
So her stepfather's angry that she inherits everything, so, I will not defend the fact that the movie was very, rapey, but, so that's, like, the first 5 minutes, is that he goes to, I guess, like, rape her younger sister, so she, like, comes to try and stop him, and accidentally shoots her younger sister, so he uses that to get her, committed, and then he's worried the cops are gonna go ask her what actually happened, and the idea would be he would inherit the money since she was committed, But he's worried the cops are going to actually ask her what actually happened, so he pays off one of the orderlies at the insane asylum to have her lobotomized. So she has, like, 5 days, before, but she knows it's going to happen. She overhears them, so she has 5 days to break out before she gets lobotomized by John Hamm, of all people. Because apparently anything set in the 50s has to have John Hamm as a, you know, handsome guy.
Oh, no, that makes sense. The whole fear of the lobotomy is such an interesting spin in films, and I hate to take this on a tangent, but I'm going to anyway. We're going to get back to Sucker Punch in a second. I saw a film this past week, and it was a recommendation from a fellow who was out at J-Tree with me. It was like a camping group, and he was telling me about this Korean horror movie called The Host. And to describe it, it was, if you can think of like Cloverfield, that sort of following... a small family be in the middle of, like, a monster attacks the city scenario and not following, like, you know, the military men or the people that make the decisions that, like, destroy the monster. No, just following this, like, family that's getting, you know, stuck in the city and trying to deal with them, living there with the monster. Kind of like Cloverfield, but, you know, making all the right choices, whereas Cloverfield made all mistakes.
Yeah. Or like Tom Cruise's War of the Worlds, except not increasingly lame in the second half.
Well, I mean, another good point is the Signs wasn't that bad.
Oh yeah, that's true. Yeah,
this is when M. Night was still able to, like, not completely broadcast the twist before the movie. before 5 minutes into the movie. So.
Well, I felt like that worked also because that was not. The twist didn't really matter in that movie. The whole movie was interesting. Whereas, I actually didn't see Unbreakable, but from what I read, it was that, like, the whole movie was just building up to the twist, and then, like, the last 5 minutes are awesome, but the whole movie, the rest of it's just like, I wonder what's wrong with Bruce Willis!
yeah, that's true. But anyway, so the thing with The Host that that I really, really appreciated is this motif of the lobotomy, and you usually think the lobotomy is this horrible threat that always goes wrong, you know? Mm-hmm. What was it in Planet of the Apes? When Taylor makes his way to the city, I believe, right in Ape City, and he finds his one friend who had been stuffed and put in the museum, and he sees his other friend, and he sees the huge scar, and it's like, oh no, he's dead to me now because he's been lobotomized by the apes. This movie, The Host, actually, and minimal spoiler alert, but we're doing sort of analysis of them, so I don't feel that bad, but. There's actually that they take the twist in a different direction, which is the guy, one of the protagonists, is actually kind of a dim-witted character who always screws up, and is kind of lazy and very lethargic. And then they give him a lobotomy, and apparently that fixes him.
Oh, so that's really like interesting.
Three quarters of the movie as this bumbling guy who's like screwing up constantly and like trying to like save his family in this monster scenario to. Like, this very clever action hero in the last, like, 20 minutes of the movie just to save the day because they got lobotomized.
Wow, that's really cool. I enjoy that. That's a clever twist. Yeah, I'd heard a lot about The Host. I'm not sure why I never saw it. Thank you for reminding me that that exists.
Well, you know, as before I was in Vienna the other week, I was in Korea, in Incheon, and I got got to get the lay of the land of what people thought about The Host there, and apparently... it made more money than Titanic in Korea.
Really? Wow, yeah. That's really cool.
And Titanic was a huge blockbuster everywhere, but The Host was apparently this huge freaking film in 2006 in Korea.
That's and impressive.
It freaking deserved it. Freaking deserved it. Let's see if I can give you. Actual thing, it made viewing figures. I want to say it sold 12.3 million tickets in a country where the population is 48 million.
Wow, so a fourth of the fucking country saw it. That's just impressive.
Yeah, and honestly, I think it deserves the attention because it really is a just all around cool movie. It's got all the aspects that you would want in a movie, which is, you know, character-driven, well-plotted, structured, good, well-paced. It's a sci-fi movie, so, like, you know, the mon- there's a monster in it, and but the monster's not too hokey. It's got sort of a moral message, but it doesn't beat you down over the head with it. The action sequences are actually pretty good. So it really had a lot going for it, and I truly, truly recommend it to anyone who hasn't seen it. Go see The Host. It's a cool thing, and it's, you know, single-handedly trying to redeem lobotomy, I guess, in our popular culture.
I'm not sure if redeeming lobotomy is something that sort of needs to happen.
I don't know, man. Have you ever tried it? Maybe we'll get smarter if we lobotomize ourselves.
Only if we're chasing a monster. But yeah.
But this girl's being chased by monsters, right? Nazis, dinosaurs, or something?
Yeah. So that's, yeah, basically when you were talking about character driven, good pacing, good plot. No, the Sucker Punch has none of that. Sucker Punch is, I mean, I will freely admit that it's, you know, very much just Zack Snyder getting free reign. Like, you know, it's the first thing that's been based on, like, that has been based on a script from Zack Snyder, and it's based on a short story entirely from Zack Snyder that, you know, like, or, you know, like, in a, like that he pitched, and then him and a guy who actually knows how to write dialogue fleshed it out. So it's entirely Zack Snyder. And so
I scribbled a plot onto a bar napkin one night, and then we got someone to actually write the script.
Yeah, the plot was hot chicks in ridiculous outfits fighting dinosaurs and Nazis. Actually, I didn't see the dinosaurs. Even though there was a dinosaur in the trailer, there was a dragon, which was awesome. But I did not see it.
I think I've mentioned my grand formula for a good film here, and I'm going to repeat it, which is, look, if you want to get people on your protagonist's side, you pit them up against four things: dinosaurs, Nazis, robots, or aliens.
All of those, except for aliens, were in this movie, actually.
Oh, that's very interesting. So, I mean, this film, from how you've described it so far, sounds like, on paper, a home run. So why wasn't it a home run?
So I guess, like, it doesn't really, like, the main issue people have with it, which is fair, is that everything, all the cool stuff, takes place in her dreams. Like, it's sort of like a metaphor for, like, they have to, like, you know, steal this map in the insane asylum. So then she, you know, like, it's her imagining how it's happening, not, but just vaguely, like, it's just a big action scene. So that's the problem, is that all the cool stuff isn't really happening, but it was...
That seems vaguely pretentious. In the Matrix, all the cool stuff's technically happening in the Matrix.
Yeah.
Except except for the last movie where they had, like, the orgy and robot fight, but...
But, yeah, it is, I guess that's the problem, is it is pretentious, and it, like, and I understand why no one's liking this, but it still made me really happy. It was basically just the most expensive, like, B-movie ever, pretty much. I mean, it's just all, like, hot chicks and corny dialogue and ridiculous accents and zombie, and clockwork Nazis. Nazis made out of steam and...
Oh, God, no. Yeah. Not the steampunk Nazis.
Yes, steampunk Nazis.
Oh, that's just terrible. Vaguely reminiscent of the character from Hellboy.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, that did remind me of that. Except these,
because there was a Nazi Gestapo agent who was clockwork and sandbags, right?
Exactly. Yes.
Yeah, that was interesting. And then Dr. Krauss. I don't know if he was a Nazi. I guess he wasn't, because he was technically a good guy. And you know, you really can't be a bad guy and then have Seth MacFarlane portray you, because Seth MacFarlane makes everyone kind of endearing.
Yeah, that was awesome. I enjoyed Dr. Krauss in Hellboy 2 a lot. Like, they made him into more of a comic character. He's much more of a tragic character in the comics.
Yeah, was he? I never actually read much of Hellboy. I like the stories that I read. I think you gave me to read once the Conqueror Worm trade paperback, and that was one of the early ones. And I liked it a lot, but the one thing about Krauss that I didn't quite get was he always a poltergeist?
No, he was, and I think there's actually, they discuss his origin in, I think, Bureau of Paranormal Research and Defense, I think, or it might be in one of the Hellboys, too. I can't remember which comic it's out of, but it's he was like sort of a mystic, like a fortune teller kind of guy, but like a legit one. And he like some guy tricked him. I believe, and like, I haven't read this in about 5 years, so I'm going to be bad with the details, but some guy tricked him to summon, he said it was, like, summoning his grandmother or something, but he's actually summoning, like, some, like, huge evil demon. So when he summoned him, there's this great panel that's the whole page of just, like, ectoplasm and, like, all these, like Krauss dissolving, and then all these, like, nightmare shapes of, like, demons and hands and stuff coming out of this huge full page of ectoplasm that's coming out of him. So basically Krauss is able to, like, keep the demon the guy was trying to summon at bay, but as a result he completely dissolves, and then I forget who finds him and puts him in a container, because if he's not in a container he would just dissipate and just no longer exist as a person.
That's kind of fascinating. Vaguely reminiscent of a story from Marvel, actually.
Interesting.
Do you know the story of Doctor Doom and Mephisto?
Only thing I know about Mephisto is there was that one Silver Surfer, I think after the Silver Surfer's wife dies or something, and Mephisto shows up on the end of his surfboard, and there's a full 2-page of the Silver Surfer bent down on his knees going, "Mephisto!" And I thought that
Well, Mephisto
really
actually appeared in the Silver Surfer originally, in, like, the Silver Surfer 3 or 4. But the whole idea was Dr. Doom, as we know, is one of my favorite comic book characters of all time. Gypsy born, by hook or by crook, became the prince of the small country of Latveria. And actually, his mother was a sorceress. Similar situation happened. There were shenanigans. The gates of hell were open, and shit had to be closed. And Doom's mother closed it at the expense of being taken into hell by Mephisto, who is the one of the Marvel versions of the devil, because apparently Marvel, just to make it clear that just to, like, confuse the fact that, you know, Mephisto just isn't Satan, Marvel has, like, 4 or 5 characters, demon characters, which, you know, are supposed to be them together inspire the concept of Satan in the Western tradition or something. I don't know.
So it's kind of them not wanting to offend anyone by having a character that's just Satan and goes around doing Satan-y things.
Even though they have a character called Satan who has a child called Damien Hellstrom, and his name, I think the title of his series back in the 70s was Son of Satan.
And wait, so, whatever. The character's name is Damien Hellstrom?
Hellstrom, like Storm, but like misspelled.
Yeah, so you're naming a character who's the son of the devil, and you go with Damien Hellstorm.
Okay, like, no. Not Damien. It wasn't a complete ripoff of the Omen. It was a Damon.
Okay, that's slightly better.
Damon.
Then he's
which
a combination.
Sort of like in between Damien and Demon. So
yeah. Okay, that's fair. I thought they were like Damien. Hell, there we go. We got our character. Moving on. Where's the cocaine?
Yeah. So to get back to sort of the Krauss parallel, so the same thing where it's like shenanigans happened with gypsies and demons, but Dr. Doom for many years they had this ongoing story where on his mother's birthday Doom would open the gates of hell and like play Mephisto in some sort of game or challenge Mephisto for his mother's soul back.
Really?
Which I thought that was kind of a neat story.
That's interesting, but Doom never wins.
Doom never wins, because the devil's a tricky little bastard.
Yeah, though apparently not as good of a fiddler as some people in Georgia.
Well, hey, apparently not as good a guitar player as Tenacious D.
That movie's such a piece of shit.
if only they remembered what the best song in the world was.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Okay, so you can hate on the movie all of it. The movie was shit, but have you ever seen, like, the HBO series?
No, you know, I never have.
HBO series, and I think it, like, ran for all of 6 episodes. It was, like, a British series. For whatever. It is spectacular.
Cool.
Like,
good,
really good. And you think, like, Tenacious D, the big offense that they commit is that they're, like, way too over the top because they have created this way too over the top sort of character for themselves, and now they're just trying to be like, you know, oh, we've set the bar so high, we have to like be obnoxious every time. This was the first sort of like their first attempt, and they were really just trying to developing their like band character, and it was really, really funny.
Awesome, I'll have to check that out. The movie, well, I think the problem with the movie is that it seems like because the first 10 minutes are so awesome. Like, the rock opera part's so awesome, and then when it just cuts to, like, you know, Kyle, like, playing a guitar in Long Beach, like, it's just this, like, interminable period of nothing happening for pretty much the rest of the movie. So I feel like if they'd made it into a rock opera, it would have been amazing. But they clearly wrote the first 10 minutes of the movie and were like, hey, that was great, let's get stoned and film the rest.
Yeah, the funny thing is that's the plot of one of the episodes of their TV show.
What is?
It's the pilot, Search for Inspirato, which is their, like, so they've been playing at this club on open mic night, and that's sort of the frame of the whole series is this, they're constantly going to this open mic night, and they're playing acoustic guitars, but they're playing, like, metal and screaming. And it's like this really low-key bar, so it's always like a very like juxtaposed sort of scene where they're going crazy with these acoustic guitars, and everyone's just kind of like confused as to what they're singing. So finally one week, the owner of the club, bar, whatever, goes up to them and says, hey, you know, it's great what you guys do. We want you to have, you know, you want to play at another club, you know, that my like cousin owns or whatever. But the catch is, you know, could you play, like, more than one song? Because they play the same song every week because it's open mic, maybe one song. and it's them, like, this epic composing process over the week of them trying to write a song, which makes it impossible because they're crazy and stoned all the time.
So pretty much that, but for, like, 6 weeks was how they wrote this movie.
Yeah, it sounds like it, but, I don't blame them for that.
No.
They do bring the funny occasionally, so.
Yeah,
man.
And Tim Robbins was funny in the movie. But Tim Robbins is always good, so that's, yeah.
He's not been much recently, has he?
What was it? Code 46 was the last, like, big thing he was in, right?
Code 46?
The one that took place in the near future, and they just filmed it at the most, like, futuristic current buildings in the world, which I thought was clever.
It's clever. I don't think I've ever seen that, actually.
I actually haven't either. It's one of those many movies that I read about and then meant to see and then forgot about until it comes up in conversation.
Well, you shouldn't have a nerd conversation with me, man, because it's definitely going to come up.
Yeah, no, I still mean to see it. Speaking of, actually, I was looking through, the, you know, complete history of my Netflix queue, which, I've had my own, I've had a Netflix,
Can you tell me how to find that? Because I would like to talk about our Netflix queues for a while, so that might be fun.
Oh, yeah, go to, just on the main page when it says, like, what you recently watched, hit see more, and then hit see more again, and you can go all the way back. Apparently, the very first thing I watched when
I got... Do I have to feed him?
What do you say?
Do I have to feed him?
Here, I'll go out again.
For those of you that are a little dense out there, that was a little Shop of Horrors joke.
Oh, Seymour. I didn't get that.
There we go. You gotta be working on a lot of cylinders to keep up with me.
No, the plant in that's called Audrey, too.
Audrey. Interesting name for a very deep double bass voice.
you see, when you go to your main Netflix account, it says...
I'm there. So let's talk about this.
Okay, so apparently the first thing I ever watched when I got a Netflix account back in January of 2010 was Zac Efron Ultimate Idol. I watched 0 minutes of it and gave it 1 star. I'm not sure how that happened. I'm not sure how any of that happened. I'm also not sure how one can watch 0 minutes of something. I assume I was merely clicking. It was part of its, you know, it was like recommendations popular this week, and I clicked on it to give it 1 star without watching it, and it instead started to show it to me. and I watched 0 minutes because I set fire to the computer.
No, stop, Zac Efron!
Yeah, I assume I just, like, threw the computer that it was on out of the window, and that's why it didn't get past even 0 minutes.
Well, I actually, I had to re-up my Netflix account because of my particular period in graduate school precluded me from being able to watch movies for hours on end at night. My first thing that I watched when I got Netflix back was, and we've actually talked about this in a previous episode, Labyrinth.
Yay!
First thing I watched was Labyrinth.
What was that?
First thing I watched was Labyrinth.
Looking at what else on here is interesting. Oh yeah, Dark Forces. Actually, that is still on Netflix streaming. Those of you listening who are looking for a good Australian supernatural thriller, which, you know, who isn't? Dark Forces, starring, I think it's Robert... No. I'll let it load and then tell you. Starring, yeah, Robert Powell. I was confused. I was thinking William Powell for a second, which is the guy from The Thin Man. But yeah, so Robert Powell, the British actor who is famous for, like, the remake of 39 Steps and then playing that same character in a British series based on the guy who falls into and sort of becomes a detective because he's trying to solve shit in 39 Steps. So this is called Harlequin everywhere else in the world except for Netflix. but it's Dark
really?
Forces... is the name of this... Harlequin is the name of the movie everywhere else, but Dark Force is what it's called here. It's the sort of... Rasputin-style guy who comes and can heal the very sick son of this senator. The movie's supposed to take place in the U.S., even though everyone in it is Australian.
Okay.
And very clearly is in Australia.
Riddle me this. Rasputin. Grigory... Yefimovich Rasputin, the mad monk, alive or dead?
Right now, I'd have to say dead. I mean, they have his penis in a jar in Russia, don't they?
You would think that, but he grew numerous ones over the course of his life. He is a superhuman, and he's still alive. And hang out with him on the weekends.
Interesting. Is that who you were in Joshua Tree with?
Yeah, he's a great rock climber.
were you burning Graham Parsons' body there?
No, you're not allowed to have fires outside of designated fire pit areas because California is very flammable.
That's a good point. That would have made that whole story about... Graham Parsons. Have you heard that story? They made a good Johnny Knoxville movie, which I know is an oxymoron, but it's like his one good movie, or at least that I like, Grand Theft Parsons.
No, I've never seen that.
It's Johnny Knoxville plays the manager of Graham Parsons, and it's cool because, like, the actual manager, like, hung out with Johnny Knoxville and loaned him all his clothes from that period and, like, his motorcycle, so it's pretty much just, like... It's a really chill, like, road movie. It's really funny, and it has a lot of, Flying Burrito Brothers music. It was Graham Parsons was one of the many members of the Byrds, but he's most, like, the music you'd know that's, like, Graham Parsons is the Flying Burrito Brothers stuff that he did, which is really good. So, it was, in the true story and in the movie, Graham Parsons died, and he had his manager promise him that when he died, he would take his body to Joshua Tree National Park and set it on fire. So he has to steal the body, and because the guy didn't have a will, and do so, and then the real, this isn't giving anything away, but the, you know, because the movie's just like this awesome stoned out story, but the real end result was both the manager and I guess the hearse driver that he'd like roped into helping him do this they confessed to, you know, yeah, we stole the body and set it on fire, and the judge ruled that the body had no intrinsic value and was the property of no one, so one cannot be charged with a crime for stealing a body. And the judge did rule, however, that they did burn the coffin, and you can't steal a coffin, so they had to pay back the funeral parlor for the cost of the coffin.
There's a very deep philosophical question we are floating around right now, which is really, once the, well, not, won't happen to us because we're immortals, but Once those mortals die, they officially lose any and all value they possibly had?
Yeah, apparently, at least in the California penal system.
Well, thank goodness we live in Valhalla.
I don't know if that's still the case, but I know that was the actual ruling for Graham Parsons' manager, whose name I will look up while we set other things. But anyway, yeah, Dark Forces / Harlequin, good Rasputin-y thriller. Because it goes in a lot of directions you don't expect it to, like sort of who the good guy is, who the bad guy is, really. They twist it around a couple times throughout, so you're not sure whether this guy is sort of a Rasputin-y kind of guy where he's preying on them, or whether he actually is trying to help the family and just happens to have supernatural powers and is also kind of a dick.
I've always kind of liked the character of Rasputin, because he has the full range of ambiguity there, where he could be like this absolutely horrific, manipulative monster, or just this like really innocent, crazy guy, and everywhere in between that spectrum. And it's not certain as to what the fuck he was. or whether he was a rock star from Mars. My vote was that. I kind of suspect that Rasputin lives on, and he goes by the name Charlie Sheen now.
Oh my god, I like that idea. I like that idea. Kind of crazy, very charismatic, likes to stab women, all things that Charlie Sheen and Rasputin have in common.
This is the theory that I've been concocting the past few days now, and I'm willing to float it in the digital medium. Rasputin, Charlie Sheen, same person. And, you know, if you got, like, poisoned and stabbed a million times and shot a million times and thrown into a freezing river only to crawl out and then supposedly die on the riverbank of exposure, but actually didn't die and went on to a hilarious career, wouldn't your response be winning? Who'd have thought?
Oh, so Kaufman is the
Andy Kaufman? Oh my god. Are we gonna like throw conspiracy theory upon conspiracy theory?
Oh, no.
And Charlie Sheen were both characters invented by Andy Kaufman.
Ooh, I like that. But no, I was just saying, with that thread finished, I was just going, or not finished, but I was just going back really quick to Graham Parsons' body being stolen. Phil Kaufman was his manager who stole the body. And yeah. It says the two were arrested several days later. Since I don't know whether this has changed, but there was no law against stealing a dead body. They were fined $750 for the cost of the coffin. They were not prosecuted for leaving 35 pounds of litter in the desert. Litter being Parsons' body and the coffin.
Yeah, that's how they would get them, though, right? Because, you know, you're not supposed to, everything you're supposed to, you know, bring to the park, you need to put it into a proper receptacle and bring it out with you.
Yeah, but that might have, but I'm sure the fines for that weren't as severe as they are now, since I feel like the litter, this was, you know, 73, so I feel like things were a lot chiller back then. Cause,
you know, Phil Kaufman was actually in the movie?
Yeah, for like a second, right?
They do a cameo for him. That's interesting.
Yeah. Well, I keep meaning to. I have the DVD around here somewhere, which I haven't been able to find. I don't know. It's I have too many like cases of DVDs, but I've been trying to watch it because it has the commentary with Johnny Knoxville and Phil Kaufman just talking about like how. What actually went down, because they obviously had to change it around a lot to make it more dramatic, since it was, you know, in real life, just a drunk and a stoner driving through the desert with a bomb.
Drunk and a stoner driving through the... Are you sure that it's not, like, Fear and Loathing?
Oh, God, that movie is fantastic.
The most interesting thing about that movie is not so much the film itself, which is wonderful, but just in, like, in every respect. But the fact that Depp lived with him before to get Hunter Thompson, he lived with him.
Yeah, on like, for like on months, a Hunter's right?
ranch, and then like Thompson made Depp like sleep in the basement with all his like stored up ammunition for like zombie apocalypse or whatever the hell he was paranoid about that week.
And the like pack of dogs in his house, right? Weren't they always yes. like chasing after Depp? Yeah, Thompson was insane. Do you know, just before he died, he got a woman freed from federal prison. She was
for what?
She was in for one of those, what's it called, robbery murder laws that some states have, where, like, if you're part of a robbery and someone dies in the course of the robbery, you're, like, held accountable for murder in the second degree or whichever that is when you shoot during a robbery. So she went to, like, steal some of her stuff out of her boyfriend's place, and with this guy that she didn't know that a friend of hers had said was good at stealing stuff. And then they got pulled over and he shot and killed the cop that pulled him over, and then I forget if there was another cop in the car who then shot and killed him. So then she was sitting in the car and then got sentenced to life in jail without parole, and Thompson got her free.
Who's she been, dicks? She was just sitting in the car! Hey, she didn't even touch the damn gun! That's... Don't let her out right now or I'll start defecating on your face!
That, I think, is pretty much...
Hunter S. Thompson.
Yeah, that was probably exactly what happened.
What's Don't trust is... those G-Men bastards!
What's funny is I believe he got this, like, you know, grassroots movement for her while he was writing for ESPN Online, because that's what he was doing for the last, like, several years of his life.
No wonder he killed himself. Jeez.
Well, I think it was more just that...
Past years of my life, I'm the most famous man in the world, and what did I do? Write for a fucking website?
Well, I think that was more a choice on his part, because they just were like, yeah, like, whatever, you can write about sports, you can write about, you know, freeing people from federal prison, you can write whatever the hell you want. Because he was still writing books, like, he had Kingdom of Fear that was his, like, autobiography, which I've only read the first chapter of, but that was excellent, about when he was being interrogated by the police for blowing up a mailbox. while a U.S. postman was... No, he, like, blew up the mailbox in front of the trucks, so that the postman, like, crashed into it, I believe, was the whole crime. This was when he was, like, 11.
This is an interesting fact. Do you know how Thompson's funeral went?
Oh, I believe it involved a cannon, right? I'll let you tell
it
the whole story.
His ashes were fired from a cannon.
Like an 100-foot-tall cannon shaped like a fist, right?
Yep, double thumb fist. And here is the interesting part. Do you know who paid for it?
Like Johnny Depp and Sean Penn, right?
Yeah, exactly, exactly. There we go. And I think, you know, like, that's got to be some Stockholm Syndrome right there. Because Johnny Depp goes to Hunter's compound. Hunter S. Thompson's like, okay, this little bastard's coming to get my mannerisms. I'm going to torture the crap out of this kid.
I don't know if it was torture or if it was more just him being like, well, let's see. I've probably spent a month of my life sleeping in a basement and, you know, being chased by wild dogs. If he wants to have a crash course and learn this in just 1 month, he better do it the whole time.
He's not willing to do as many drugs as I did, then he has to do it for real. I hallucinated this shit, but I'm gonna chase you with dogs.
There is a great non sequitur in Campaign Trail of 72, which I think is Thompson's best book, at least of the ones I've read, where he's writing about Nixon or something, and then he says, outside of my hotel room roaming the beach right now are packs of dogs, you know, ripping apart campaign workers who stayed out too late, and then he just goes back to what he was talking about.
Hunter S. Thompson is a very interesting character, and I like him particularly more because there's just this wonderful parody of him that I have fallen in love with on the Venture Brothers. I don't know if you've ever seen that.
I actually, I've only seen what you've shown me, so I've seen the episodes where that character has had a sex change.
Ah, yes. But I mean... I think that's why I like the Venture Brothers, because if you get how crazy Hunter S. Thompson was, their parody of him is spot on. Because if you put Hunter S. Thompson in more stressful, more spy, more cloak and dagger situations, the escalation of craziness would probably match up perfectly.
That's true. And they really have the delivery down, and I love the way they illustrate him. Like, I think it's a, like, it's hard with, like, Doonesbury, you know, has a Hunter S. Thompson character, but it's hard.
Oh, yeah, that guy.
It's hard on a still, you know, comic drawn. Like Doonesbury's awesome, but the way it's drawn, it's hard to sort of capture Thompson's energy. Like, I feel like the only way you could capture Thompson's energy in a still drawing format is, like, the way Ralph Steisman did in all these illustrations for Thompson's books, where it's just ink everywhere and like a million lines showing like a million hands showing movement. I feel like, you know, in the show, they're able to much more capture like just like the jerky movements and the like constantly like twiddling with the, you know, his cigarette holder and everything.
Yeah, my favorite quote is there is this one episode where there's like a really young guy who's working for the Office of Special Intelligence, and Hunter is like his handler, spy handler for the mission, and they're like they're investigating a supervillain on a college campus, and you know, to go undercover, the Hunter character, Hunter Gathers, like disguises himself as a cheerleader, and you know, like at this point, we already know that he's had the sex change, so we're like gesturing towards like tendencies he's had or something like that. anyway, like the like little like reluctant agent is like, "This isn't fair, guys! I didn't sign up for this." And he turns around and is like, "If you think there's a god and he's fair, he would have made me with big, beautiful tits like these. But there isn't one. So you do your job, soldier."
That's fantastic.
That is captured in, like, the...
One sec, sorry, man, you cut out again.
But anyway, but I think that quote really, like, captures the insanity of Hunter Thompson.
Yeah, you're back in. Yeah, that's true. And that's, like you said, it is, you know, it's impossible to make an over-the-top version of Thompson, because he was just such an over-the-top version of life, of, you know, of everything.
It's like, really, if you shoot high enough and you think you're like, this can't possibly be true, this is way over the top, if you take that to the most extreme, you might get there. Like, you might start like touching what he actually was.
Exactly, yeah. I like that in both Fear and Loathing and in Las Vegas and Camping Trail 72, they end with there's, for Camping Trail 72, the last entry, because it's, you know, it's a compilation of Rolling Stone articles, the last entry is literally him being interviewed by his editor, because he is just, the campaign just ended, and he just did so many drugs the last couple weeks that he isn't able to type. So, the last thing is, like, they take all of his dispatches that they've sent him, that he sent to the editor, you know, just his raw, you know, the, like, thousands of words he was writing daily, that he was, you know, I guess, faxing over to the editor, and, or would have been, like, I guess a Mojo machine back then, I'm trying to remember how they would send it, and the editor reads through, and he goes, "So, the scene where you're talking about being at the Kentucky Derby, and, Henry Kissinger comes at you wearing, you know, leather assless chaps and a ball bag."
Leather chaps, always the correct answer to anything, right?
Yeah. They're like, "So was this a metaphor for how you felt they stole the election? Or is this something that you're purporting actually happened while you're on the campaign trail?" And he's like, "Yeah, they were all there. Nixon was dressed up in a rubber gimp suit," and like he just goes into this whole like not bad
guy. Yes, Nixon was there. Crystal meth's a hell of a drug.
Yeah. Well, and also in that he actually got to back in. Oh God, it couldn't have even been the first. Maybe it was Nixon's first presidential campaign. Or maybe it was the one he lost to Kennedy, but I know that at some point Thompson was the only, at least he purports, but, you know, most of the stuff they've, you know, verified that, you know, the stuff that's not obviously satire actually happened, was that Thompson was the only guy who happened to be in the press that were following Nixon at that time who knew anything about football, or knew enough about football to hold a 2-hour conversation with Nixon. So Nixon was going to be driving, and he didn't want to talk to any of his advisors, he didn't want to talk to any reporters, he just wanted to talk to someone for 2 hours about football. So Thompson agreed. He said, I won't pull any punches, I won't ask any weird questions, I'll just talk to him about football, which leads to the quote, He goes, Richard Nixon may have barely qualified as a human being in my eyes, but God damn it, did that man know his football.
Oh, freaking Thompson is great. So on that note, I think it might be time to wrap up the Hour of Thunder tonight. Balder the Brilliant signing off from Joshua Tree National Park. Hopefully, in the following weeks, I will be in a sunnier locale, perhaps the Kamchatka Peninsula in Siberia, because at this point, I bet it would snow less there than it does in the frickin' California desert.
Oh, hey, were you ever near Cap Rock, which is apparently a prominent natural feature in Joshua Tree?
I might have been, but I don't know.
Okay, because apparently Cap Rock is where Graham Parsons' ashes were spread.
Well, before I leave the desert, I shall endeavor to go there and enlighten all who visit the ashes of Graham Parsons scattered about the desert.
Yeah, it looks like there's a I'm not sure if it's still there, but they have a photo of like a little memorial with like rocks and. Like someone spray painted like his name into the ground that's in Joshua Tree.
Well, that's freaking cool. So I will check that out. So, ladies and gentlemen, boys and germs, this is Baldur the Brilliant signing off for Thor, God of Thunder. This was the Hour of Thunder. Holla at us at thorshourofthunder@gmail.com.
Thorhourofthunder@gmail. Thorshourofthunder@gmail. Hourofthunder@gmail.
We got them all.
Yeah. Or just send one to a Gmail address of your choosing and see if it gets to us.
It'll get to us somehow. Damn it.
Right.
Okay, so, good night, America.
Oh, you gotta do the this would have been the first one that you didn't do the shadow sign up.
Oh, goodness gracious me. Okay, so for all of you out there that want a moral to the story, here it is: the weed of crime bears bitter fruit. Crime doesn't pay, and the shadow knows. Boop boop boop.